I want to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30, Mark. I'm 27 now. You know, I've had great success. I've earned a lot of money. I've spent a lot of money.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Alicia Birch.
I'm a very, very good judge of character. So I know straight away whether someone's going to do me over or not.
Okay.
There's certain things like red flags that I can clock on people and I'm like, I don't trust you. And if I don't trust someone implicitly, I'm not doing business with them. That is a big, big rule for me.
Alicia is the managing director of Fortify based in Manchester. She founded the business in May 2024 and they are a specialist recruitment company in the construction industry.
I worked from 8 o'clock in the morning till 1 o'clock in the morning. That was because I was just rammed with calls all day and night. I'm okay with that. I'm obsessed with the job, so I love it, and I don't expect other people to do that.
After 8 years in the industry, Alicia has become a leading voice in the residential new build market. Alicia's career got off to a rough start the first 3 years with zero income, but plenty of lessons.
So then I went to the second company where I did that and still just didn't make any money. It couldn't click. I don't know what it was. I was great at speaking to people. I was terrible at recruitment.
But once things clicked, she went to consistently smashing records year after year. Alicia believes in honest conversations and a deep understanding of what makes great teams tick.
Business development is everything. Like, and a candidate is business development for me. There's no separation in the candidate and the client world for me. They are all the same things. Loads of my candidates are now my clients. Loads of my clients are now my candidates.
She's now expanding in both the UK and the US. Alicia's on a mission to connect market leaders to the market and have fun while doing it. Interestingly, she does not make cold calls yet still achieves great results. So I'm keen to hear her success strategies. Alicia, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
I'm excited. So happy 1 year anniversary in business.
I know, literally to the day as well. So that's been, it's been a wild year. I know why everyone says that they don't do it now.
Right?
I understand it.
It's not the easy path. That is for sure. So credit to you for not only surviving your first year, but
thriving in it.
Thriving, exactly. So is it literally today? Is that the
anniversary? It was last week. So okay. Our official 1 year anniversary was last week.
Amazing.
And yeah, it has been great. It's been stressful, fun. I think now I'm learning to settle into enjoying the journey a bit more. That's probably the key bit.
Absolutely. Well, I'd love to hear that journey over the last 12 months. Before we get to that, I have to tell our listeners, definitely check you out on LinkedIn, because that's how I found you. You came across my radar because you're very consistent publishing good content on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
So building your personal and business brand is obviously something that you're good at and you emphasize. So it's obviously working. That's how we found you.
I hope so.
But how did you get into recruiting in the first place?
So going way back when I was around, I've always worked since I was about 14. I've always had a really, really strong work ethic. And in, you know, my family don't come from money. So it was like, if you want something, you got to go out, earn your money, buy it if you want it. And that's probably fueled my massive shopping addiction I've got now. But I originally started working in a gym, a really high-end gym with celebrities, footballers. And then I went and worked in a restaurant with the same sort of clientele. I've just always been really, really good at speaking to people. Then I was like, right, I need a proper job, like whatever that is.
Right.
Fell into recruitment, as everyone does. To be fair, the first company I worked at, it was a small business, very, very similar to us, like not that many people, small team growing. And I was an absolute nightmare. I was, 18, 19, out on the lash every night, like coming in hungover, falling asleep at my desk. Like I was just the worst employee ever. But then I left there because the reason why I left there was because I really wanted growth. I wanted to do things myself and I wanted to own it. And they were like, no, you just need to be a resourcer. And I was like, no, I want clients. I want to be out there. So then I went to the second company where I did that and still just didn't make any money. It couldn't click. I don't know what it was. I was great at speaking to people. I was terrible at recruitment.
All right. So let's dive into this because I think this could be super helpful to a lot of people. But So for, wait, you did warn me that you're honest. So I'm getting true, authentic.
You get what you're given with me. There's no other side.
I like it. So your first job, you've worked since you're 14, but your first professional job, let's say in an office, working for this recruitment company.
Yeah.
But you, it doesn't sound like.
I hated it.
Right. It didn't work out. How long did you last there before you moved on? 6 months. Okay.
Yeah.
So then when you moved to the next business, first of all, I think in the prep for this, I read that you didn't have any income for 3 years. How did you actually survive?
So I got my salary, which was absolute pennies. Like, if you think about it now, you know, you hire a trainee consultant. They come in on around 20. I was on like 16 grand, if that. Like, it was just pennies. I don't know how I lived, because now I'm like, I couldn't imagine anything worse. But I mean, as you know, an 18, 19 year old, it was a lot of money. Like, I didn't have a car, didn't have rent, live with my parents. But I just used to have a really, really good social life. So all my money went on alcohol and going out and having fun. And I think that realistically, you know, I wasn't very money motivated, if I'm being totally transparent. Like, I wasn't surrounded by anyone that was making amazing money. These businesses weren't really high performing businesses. So you were around people that were just making enough to get by, and you were kind of like, well, my salary's enough. So I wasn't really too bothered. I didn't understand how it worked. I didn't understand how to put the pieces together. I didn't actually see anyone making amazing money. So I was just like, what is that?
Okay. So you were living at home, so you didn't have any overhead. So no. You're like 16K. All right.
It's funny.
My first salary in recruitment was 10,500. That was a long time ago, though.
I could have probably lived on that.
I couldn't. That was, I was in a new country. You know, trying to build life for myself with my now wife, then girlfriend. So I was super money motivated. Don't take this the wrong way, Alicia. Did you not get fired?
Well, the thing is, when I worked at the restaurants, I was very much tip based. So yeah. I used to make it was like 3 grand a month, like hourly. Worked out. And then I used to make £500 to £700 a week in tips. So I was money motivated, but for cash in my hand. I wanted to see the £10, £20, £50 notes in my hand. I think that the game of recruitment felt long and strenuous. It just felt...
It is a long game, for sure.
Yeah, it's the total long game. It wasn't quick. The reason I didn't get fired, because I was very, very good at being a people person. I knew, like... Even though I didn't make any money, I was booking meetings with influential people. I was getting in the rooms that other people weren't. And people were like, it's going to come. There's going to be a penny drop moment and she's going to be a millionaire. And I mean, it never happened with them, but luckily my next company definitely did.
Okay. So it doesn't sound like you were provided with much in the way of training coaching or whatever. Because
no. I had a lovely, lovely manager who was still to this day, I'm friends with him. He was the nicest guy in the world, but it came from a place of instead of really, really strategic growth and strategic recruitment, it was a case of just need to get a fee in. And I don't work like that. I am a type A. I need to plan my life out. Their method and what they were doing. It was very politics, you know, like very bitchy, and like there's a lot of politics to it. And it just became a big whirlwind of distractions. But I just knew what to say and how to speak to people. That was it. That was the only reason why I kept my job.
All right. This is blowing my mind, Alicia.
I know.
Because it sounds like based on the background you described, you're like the ideal trainee, right? So you're someone who's working, who's got that work ethic, worked since they were 14. Hospitality is a great training ground because you learn the people skills, and also it's like hard work, and you're obviously good at talking and building rapport with people. Mm. And so this seems like a perfect trainee, but if you don't then give that person the onboarding, the training, the support, the coaching, and the framework, then, you know, it makes sense to me why you were a slow starter.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, is role models. Like you mentioned, you didn't really see anyone around you who was a big biller. So it's you can't emulate anybody then, right?
And 100%. And I'm a sponge as well. I thrive in environment. And if I mean, I love training. I personally, you know, when I set the business up, onboarded a business coach straight away. I was like, I need someone to look up to. When I hired my team, onboarded this amazing trainer who basically is like coming along the journey with us. He's fantastic. And I wanted to give everyone the opportunity to succeed. Yes, I have made mistakes when it came to hiring by hiring the wrong personalities and people, but I didn't want to replicate what I had because I could have been in a completely different situation had I made money in that first 3 years. I'm glad I didn't because it did teach me a lot, but I also would never want anyone to experience what I had because it was like running through toffee. It was just the worst start. And then I think that, like you said, you know, role models are really important because I need to be able to look at someone and go, I want to be like you, whether it's in personal life, work life. I need to be around people that inspire me to make me better. And I think some people do, when you go into some of these businesses and people are, you know, everyone's, you know, just want to do the 9 to 5 and I just want to get my money and go in, like, for me, that doesn't work. I don't want to be surrounded by people like that, if I'm honest. As nice as they are, nothing personal. I just cannot gel with people like that.
So, Alicia, first of all, I've already asked you why I didn't get fired. I'm still not 100% sure why, but what, on the flip side, why didn't you quit? Like, how did you keep going and keep working at it when you were seeing no real return for your effort?
I mean, I did try and leave a couple of times, I'm not going to lie. I mean, the funniest part of this is I did try and leave and then my CV landed up on my boss's desk by a recruiter.
Oh.
And he was like, are you leaving? I was like, no, I don't know why they've got like the most up-to-date CV you've ever seen in your life. I had everything on there. But it was a tough one because I was comfortable. I knew that I was never going to get fired. I just knew I wasn't because I was, you know, I was a valuable person in the business, not from a financial standpoint. I just knew everyone and everyone's like, your network is your net worth. And I think they were hoping that there would be this penny drop moment that I'd make loads of money and then they would obviously be rich in the return. It was actually during COVID that I left that business.
Okay.
So obviously with furlough and stuff like that, there were a few things that I was asked to do and I was like, no, like this just isn't for me anymore. Like I don't really want to be there. And I actually went and had a conversation with my last business that I worked with. Well, not my last business, but the business before. Because I've had a couple, you know, I've worked at a few different recruitment companies now before setting up on my own. I just went there and got a good vibe. And I was just like, these are the type of people I want to be around. Like, you know, the guy that I worked for was a massive part of my career. Like, I'll always credit my career to him because he was brilliant. But he was like an ADHD, like nut job podcast, listen to podcasts all the time. It's like, yeah, we need to do it. And I was just like, yeah, I'm on the journey.
Okay. So let's give him a shout out. Who was that boss?
So that was James Layton and Rick Ollerton and Marcus Blackburn, who they were all my managers when I was in that business. And do you know what? Credit to James. He took a chance on me when I hadn't made any money. And there was no proof of anything. He was just like, look, it's a risk, but I'm willing to take it. And that was really where my career started, I would say. I sort of write off the first 3 years and then the next three are better.
Fantastic. Did you know James has been on this show?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
I need to listen to that one.
It's a few years ago, but yeah, it was a good episode. So, okay. So what was it that when things really clicked into place for you, what do you attribute that turning point to? And then I know that you really took off at that point. So what kind of success did you then start achieving and how did you turn things around?
So when I joined Anderson James, I straight away training. They were like, right, we're going to sit down once every 2 weeks. We'll do this training. We'll bring this trainer in. And I thrived in training. I loved it. And that was really apparent that I probably should have had some training at the start of my career.
Yeah, because no kidding.
Once I'm in that environment, I'm brilliant. I will listen and absorb everything. And I had a trainer called Barham, who I have actually used since leaving there. And it was funny because he came in and he was like listening to my calls in my ear. And I was just so uncomfortable. I absolutely hated it. And I just had this breakdown. And then from that day, it was like something just clicked and I knew how to put the pieces together. And me and Barham still laugh to this day. And we're like, breakdown to breakthrough.
Okay, wait a second. What was the breakdown about?
Basically, I was on the phone to a client and Baron was whispering in my ear and I just wanted to strangle him at that point. And then I wouldn't let the client off the phone. He was like, you know, he was like, look, I've got to go. I was like, no, I've got one more thing. And Baron was like, yeah, that was, and I just felt like I just could not do it. I was just like, you're trying to change me too much and it's not working because now I feel too out of my usual flow. And yeah, that was it really. And then I was just sat there crying and they were like, we don't want to change you. Like, go back to doing it how you were doing it before. But I'd picked up things from these training sessions that I went back to doing it how I was doing it before, but with this like little toolkit to get through certain situations that I haven't been able to get through before.
What was if you could point to two or three specific things that took you from breakdown to breakthrough, then what were those key pieces of the puzzle that just were missing?
I mean, I will be trading breakdown to breakthrough when I release my book.
Yeah, it's a good title.
So one of the key things was business development and the not thinking that you've got to get a job off every single phone call. It's the small little nuggets and breadcrumbs that people leave you that actually allow you to build a successful business. So for me, I would be booting myself, be like, oh, I've spoke to loads of people, I've not got any jobs, but I did find out someone moved. I found out they'd lost someone on the team. I'd found out someone's name from somewhere else. Like, it was all these little things that I was just overlooking. And then they never used to register with me. So the things that I was lacking was the attention span to not focus on the job. It was less so about the job, more so about business development. What's that business doing? Getting really under the skin of what they were doing and being able to actually understand who's moving where and what they are.
Yes.
That was the biggest thing for me. The second thing would probably be around how I was presenting myself. I previously, you know, if you know a UK construction, there's like biscuit girls that go onto site with biscuits.
I've not heard that expression.
Low cut tops and short skirts. And I thought that was the way forward. And then I remember going to Anderson James and James was like, you are not allowed to take biscuits anywhere. And he put a ban on the biscuits because it immediately, the reason that you're going is because you've got something for them. And it's like, is it just a bit of a cap? There's no seriousness to it and no weight to the conversation or your presence. So the biscuits got banned. That was a really great thing for me. I was always, you know, I was always just going like, oh, I'm just gonna come and drop some biscuits off. No, I'm coming to speak to you about something really serious here, like about your career and what your business is doing. And all they were bothered about was whether I've got rich teas or hobnobs. And I was just like, you know, it's that sort of change of, it's elevating your status. The third thing would be not putting clients on a pedestal. Oh, that was something that I was really bad at. I thought that clients ruled the world. And I was just like this little, please, sir, can I have some more? When in actual fact, I was the expert and, you know, they worked with me. I don't work for them. They work with me. So just changing mentality really for that.
I love that shift mindset. I don't work for them. They work with me. So
yeah,
well said. I like it. So then you went from like getting nowhere to billing, I think it was 250K that year?
Yeah, 250K and then 350. And then the year before I left, it was sort of around 270, 280.
Okay, fantastic. So just to translate into dollars for our US audience, 250 is about $350,000 USD.
Yes.
And the next year, 350, that's more like, let's call it 450, 500, something like that. So those are a couple of really solid years.
From zero is great.
Yeah. What a transformation. Holy cow. So you talked about some of the key shifts you made. Can I just understand a little bit in terms of your business model, are you contingent? Is it retained?
The business model I worked at Anderson James was a lot of contingent work because it was lower level site managers and stuff like that. And then I was branching out into other regions. So we built, we had people that worked in those teams and they were, you know, I would go in and do main business development and at an exec level. And then they would then go into the conversations and say, oh, we work with this company in this area. Can we do this? So I really set the foundations of being able to go into these other businesses and start these other business units, which was great. Like, you know, I really, really enjoyed it. And I think that when it came to longevity factor, I'm very good at turning clients into friends, and they are my friends. You know, there's probably some clients that I will be inviting to my wedding when I get married.
Wow.
You know, it's people that have been on the journey. I've had the same clients for about 8 years.
Amazing. So, well, okay. We're going to get into BD strategies and roundtables and all kinds of stuff like that. Let's talk about the chapter of starting Fortify. And what inspired this entrepreneurial epiphany?
I actually had no choice. So when I left Anderson James, I actually joined a business to go to America. I've taken it off my LinkedIn for a reason. And I was there for about 2 months, and I worked with the most amazing consultants I have ever come across, in the sense of their person. I've made some friends for absolute life there. Like, it was 2 months of hell, but we had a great time in hell.
2 months of hell.
and I met some really, really amazing people. But it was just the realization, when you work for people that really don't align with your values or morals, and your ethoses and my core values personally, it feels so uncomfortable. And I think that I'd had a couple of experiences where things had really gone against what I believe in. And I just realized, like, if they can do it, why am I not doing it? And why am I working so hard for other people to build everyone else's dream? Because I'm not shy of work hours. When I was at Anderson James, I was working early in the morning till late at night. Every day of the week, I was working weekends. I was staying behind and filming videos for LinkedIn. Like, I was doing everything that I needed to do. I then went to this other business and I did $100,000 in 6 weeks.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was. So I'd started there and just kind of gone boom straight away, like build. And they were like, oh, you're amazing. But the way they treated everyone, I couldn't gel with that. And I think that it was a realization that I think if I carry on going to these other businesses, I'm just going to feel the same. Something doesn't feel right. And I will always say that going to that company was the universe's way of directing me into what I'm doing now. But I felt like I had no choice but to set up my own business. And Ed, my partner, you know, he was like, you just need to do it. Like, you know, you're so good. And he told me for ages to do it. And I was like, no, I can't. And I think that the resistance was just because I didn't believe in myself enough. And even though I was great at the job, I just didn't believe in myself.
Okay. Interesting. So what was the moment that you had this realization and you made that decision? Like, I don't want to work in this environment anymore. And, you know, even though you didn't 100% believe in yourself, you decided you were going to take the plunge.
It was basically, I decided to leave the business. They'd ended up taking a load of commission off me, and I thought, oh. So I had no money. I started the business with £36 in my bank account, and I put my, to incorporate the business and get an address at a remote office, I'd put it all on a credit card. And I was like, this just has to work. Like, I just have no choice. It has to work. And then one of my clients who I'm very, very good, he was like, look, just set up on your own. Like, we'll help you. Like, you know, we're here for you. And I knew as soon as I set the business up, I'd have work, clients, everything. So, you know, it was a bit easier because I was in a scenario where I actually had people that believed in me, and my clients were the people that were like, why? Like, do it. We're here. And everyone was encouraging me. But it did take me a while to really come round to the idea, because the first the moment that I incorporated the business, I was dragging my feet. And, you know, I was like, oh, I don't know if I could do this. And it did take a while, but I just think it was the realization that I have this idea in my head of what I want my life to be. I'm not going to get that working for other people.
What was that idea in your head?
I want to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30, Mark.
I love it. Okay.
I'm 27 now. And okay. I've had great success. I've had an amazing, I've earned a lot of money. I've spent a lot of money. The one thing I think that, you know, at Anderson James, I've never earned so much money in my life, and I had absolutely nothing to show for it. So, yeah.
It's, you'll probably need to spend less than you make in order to achieve that millionaire dream by 30.
I know. Do you know what? I was like typical new money in like Gucci jumper, like printed out. I was like, yeah, I've got it. But, you know, the realization as you get older that those things aren't forever. And I think I mean, I'm very big on, I would love my own property development company one day. That's a goal of mine. The only way that I'm going to be able to do that is to make a lot of money. And that's where, you know, I don't take any commission out of this business at all. I don't take any money out of it. Yeah, I take like a salary and stuff, but I do not take anything out of the business because I'm like, that's just going to sit there for that dream.
I love it. Okay. So you decided, and that was like just over a year ago, right? And
yeah, so I incorporated the business on the 29th of April, okay. And I didn't actually start doing anything till May.
Okay. So this is the million pound question is, how have you had such a strong first year in business? Now, you've given a few clues. You had relationships that you'd built up over 8 years. Mm-hmm. And so you weren't starting from complete scratch. But nevertheless, there's no guarantee that they're going to work with you or that they're going to have like hiring needs when you need them, right? Because we already discussed, it's a long game. Like, even if they like you, they may just not have a need right now. So talk to me about what you've been doing over the last 12 months to really set up a successful business.
So we stripped our client list. So we now work with less clients, but do more money. So there is the thing when you work with a business is that you are ridden on targets, KPIs, you need to speak to X amount of people. I really, really pulled it back when I set the business up and I was like, I don't need to speak to everyone. I need to speak to the people that respect me. You know, I have good relationships with. And I did, I ended up going on a bit of a journey of who was there for me when I needed them and building on that. Mm-hmm. And I think that really taught me that there was a lot of people that I was calling friends who, when I actually needed them, weren't there. You know, these were clients and whoever else is involved. And I think that when you actually strip it back, you realize how much it actually takes for people to support you. It's quite a big thing. You know, when you're setting a business up and you're having to go out and be like, can you help me? Like, it's quite a vulnerable place to be. And I'm not very, very good at asking for help. I'm terrible at asking people for things. So when I set the business up, I cut down the list. I was like, right, who have I got the best relationships with and how can I maximize those relationships and make sure I've got more stability than just, it's all well and good billing high numbers, but if your clients are transactional and chop and churn, when they close or they, you know, they strip back on their recruitment, you've got a massive gap then because you're not able to actually facilitate anything in the business because you've got one contact and it's one revenue stream. We have learned to create multiple revenue streams in different businesses.
Can you say more about that? What does that mean?
Yeah. So say, for example, I've got a big client at the moment. I only ever used to recruit for their operational division. So I was only ever responsible for site managers and assistants, contracts managers and stuff like that. Since I've set up the business, we have been recruiting for exec positions in their sales division, operational division, HR division, commercial division, and technical division.
Got it.
So we're just creating multiple revenue streams in each client, basically.
Got it. So you're recruiting for house builders primarily, is that right?
Yeah. But so we house builders and custom home companies, yeah.
But you're recruiting cross-functionally in all the different departments within those companies.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Which I wasn't doing before.
Okay.
I have then utilized those relationships to set up our other division, which is civil engineering, because every house builder uses a civil engineering company to actually do the sites and do the groundwork. So I hired a guy who I've known for years. He actually was a civil engineer. So I've cut out a lot of time when it comes to him learning the market because he is the expert. He was there. He was once one. And we've used our client base to actually refer us to clients for civil engineering. So now we've got multiple revenue streams in addition to this revenue stream.
Okay, this is getting interesting. So how many people are in your team at the moment then?
So we have 3 people in our team. We're looking to grow to 5 by the end of the year.
Okay, great. So is that 3 including you? So
yeah, 3 including me. And then my partner who is involved in the business, he basically just works with me and just does, you know, he's building the American division for us and focusing predominantly on building out a database for that.
Okay, we're going to come on to the US
separately.
Separately. I'm trying to stay structured
here. There's so much to unpack.
All right.
So the guy that works for me, he is the other billing person in the business.
Got it.
There's only two billers.
Okay. So it's yourself, and then you hired another guy who's focuses on civil engineering. You're the two billers.
Yeah.
Your partner, what is his job?
He just is me. Is me in America. So he does. He basically resources all the American candidates.
Okay, so he recruits the candidates for the U.S. market.
Yeah. Well, I speak to them. He just finds them and gets.
Oh, so he's. I would call that a sorcerer.
So yeah. So we did. We did actually have someone else at Christmas, but we had to let them go at Christmas, which was a whole other challenge that I've never faced.
Okay. We may or may not talk about that because there's too many things to talk about.
Yeah, but I know. Could be here all day.
Exactly. Well, so you've got, there's three of you at the moment that the business is supporting. You're looking to hire two more, got it, this year, 2025, right?
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. So you've explained your strategy of actually working with fewer clients, but only the ones that are actually better quality clients.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is your specific criteria for evaluating which clients you want to work with?
Oh, that's a great question. I think for me, I'm a very, very good judge of character. So I know straight away whether someone's going to do me over or not.
Okay.
There's certain things like red flags that I can clock on people. And I'm like, I don't trust you. And if I don't trust someone implicitly, I'm not doing business with them. That is a big, big rule for me. If I can't trust you, I do not want to be anywhere near you because I think it's too much of a risk as a new company to engage and waste time as money. And I'm too early in the process to be messed around on fees or placements. Like when, say, for example, when we are getting new clients on, because we have onboarded quite a few new clients that I've never worked with before. If they're trying to do me down on fees, absolutely not. If you can't see my value, I certainly don't see yours. That's a big thing for us. You know, if we're negotiating fees and we go in and they're like, can you do 10%? No, I'm not a 10% person. Like the candidates and the experience that you're going to have working with our business is not, I wouldn't get out of bed for 10%. Like it's too, and I know it sounds cocky and I know it sounds really like sure of myself. But that's the only way for you to actually grow as a business is to be so sure and be able to walk away and say no.
Agreed. Yep, 100%. So this is a topic in itself we could spend a lot of time on, but I want to move on. What I will say is I'm going to send you, Alicia, we have a job order matrix where you actually grade each job before you work on it. Mm. And it's got 13 different factors. And by the way, for any listeners who want to see a copy, just reach out to us and we'll send it out to you.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
And that way, because what you're talking about, your intuition, your judge of character, obviously that isn't important. Like, do they respect you and do they are they aligned with your values? That kind of stuff, right? This is kind of looking more at the things like the 10%, like will they pay our full fee? Will they actually pay the fee when the invoice comes, right?
Yeah.
Are we working with them either retained or exclusive? Do mm-hmm. we have access to all the stakeholders or do we only have to talk to talent acquisition or what have you, right? So mm-hmm. there's a list of criteria like that. But
I do think though, the difficulty is when you're new to recruitment, you don't have that initial intuitive, you know, feeling of like, is this, you're doing it on the facts and the questions that you ask.
Yeah.
So as you get older and you get more into it and you're doing the job for a while, you just kind of know whether, you know, I've actually split my business now. So I do 60% retained, 40% contingent. That's been great for us. Like, you know, that guarantees a lot more and we don't work on the role till it's paid.
Yeah.
Because I just think there's, as much as people might think that's me being a bit, you know, sure of myself. So I don't have the time. I say no to so much work that I really, really need to be particular and it needs to be something that I can fill.
Yes.
I'm not going to do it.
Alicia, you're absolutely doing the right thing. And so, look, I've interviewed a lot of really big billers on the show and worked with many over the last 20 plus years as a coach as well. And big billers are working the same hours as someone who is potentially an average biller, but they're only working with clients where they have a high probability of success, and they're only representing candidates that they have a good chance of placing. So deciding who you work with and who you say no to is a really important decision that you're making on a day-to-day basis. So, but to have walkaway power and for it not to be a bluff, but you genuinely are going to say no and you have that walkaway power means that you have to have enough pipeline. So what do, and I think I read that you don't cold call. So how do you develop business?
I hate cold calling. Do you know what? I know I am. And do you know, I'm actually really good at cold calling. That's the worst part. I'm great at it. But my idea of cold calling isn't a script. Like I won't go in and be like, hi, this is a cold call. No, I'm just go, hi. Like, so I'm just very much myself.
Okay.
When I do business development, I am very, very big on research and referrals. So all my business that I've won has always been off, I know someone who knows this person. And my leading thing is, I was speaking to Gary and he mentioned that you two have worked together at a previous company, or he mentioned that I should reach out to you, or we've been doing work in this division or that division. Like everything that I do is warm. What has massively helped on that is my personal brand. I am so big on building a really strong personal brand. So if I ring someone and I've never spoke to them and I go, hi, it's Alicia Birch. They go, hi, you're right. Because they've seen something about me somewhere. And it's like, I'm that annoying thing. You don't know me, but you know a lot. You know where I am. You know what I'm doing. You know where I am. You know who I am, but you don't know where you know me from.
I totally get that. And I agree 100% with you that building a personal brand massively has a massive positive impact on your outbound business development strategy as well. So let's just break this down a little bit though. So you're making calls to people where you've been referred to them by somebody else.
Yeah.
Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. Now, so I'll always map out a business. So I'll speak to someone, whether it's a client or a candidate, I'll map out the business. And I'll find out everyone that works there, everyone that works for them, everyone at their previous company that they used to work at. And I'll ask questions about who heads things up where, here, there, and everywhere. And then I'll go, they'll mention a name and am I all right to mention you? And they go, yeah, of course. Yeah, it's fine. We went to play golf last week, or we were at the, you know, watching a concert the week before, whatever it might be. And then I will go into that conversation. I'll always ask though, because I think it's rude not to. Another thing that I was going to say afterwards though, but then I'll always see whether they're all right with it. Because the worst thing would be if they go back and they go, I never said you could speak to them.
Okay. So just let me clarify, is this a candidate or a client or either?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're talking to them about the structure of their team, their company, who's who does what, et cetera. What's the actual words that you say to get their permission, for lack of a better word, their endorsement to go and talk to someone and mention their name?
So normally it would be a case of if I'm speaking, so I'll put it in a candidate sense. So they are talking about a business that they used to work with. They reported into a construction director. So I'll be like, how was your relationship with them? Oh yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. So did you leave on good terms? Yeah, we left on really great terms. I still speak to them now. And I'll be like, do you know what's going on in their business? And I'll kind of sound it out and just see how well they are in that field. Because I think sometimes everyone's like, yeah, everything was fine. Then you ring someone and they go, oh no, I've sacked them. And it's like, oh, that's embarrassing. Like, you know, you just sound like you're on the back foot already. But I'll normally just be like, you know, what was your relationship like with them? How did you work with them? And then when they mention that person, I'll go, well, I'll just say, oh, I'm actually speaking to them in a week or so. Am I all right to mention you? Even if I've not got that call book, that person doesn't need to know that. That's, you know, I'll find a way of getting this person. If I genuinely know that they've got a good relationship, I'll just be like, oh, I was looking to speak to them actually about something. Have you got a number or an email address that I can take? And I'll get that from that person. But for me, business development is everything. Like, and a candidate is business development for me. There's no separation in the candidate and the client world for me. They are all the same things. Loads of my candidates are now my clients. Loads of my clients are now my candidates. So there is no separation in that world. Everyone is an opportunity to develop business in some way, shape, or form.
Well said. I love it. That's great, Alicia. tell me, from each, like, how many of these conversations are you having in a typical day, typical week?
Oh, I probably speak to 30 people a day-ish. Like, whether it's a client that I've worked with before as well, I'll still have these conversations because I'm like, what's this person doing? What's that person doing? Do you know what my best trait is? I'm so nosy. And people think it's a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. Because if you said to me, oh, you know, this happened, I'd be like, why? Where? I'd ask every question. I need to find out every detail about what happened, where, why, when, how, who, everything. And I am the nosiest person in the world, but that's what's made me really good at this job because I'm so passionate. I just have to know. I won't be able to sleep at night. Like when I don't ask something, I'll ring the person back and I'll be like, oh, I've got to ask you this. Like, because I would not be able to go home without knowing. I will not be able to do it.
Okay.
So every day you look at
30 people a day is a lot.
I know, but there's sometimes quick calls. There's sometimes, oh, I've just thought of this. But every single call is a business development call for me.
Got it. So we're talking about 150 a week, basically, conversations. Yeah. Okay. And then do you have a goal in mind from each call of getting X number of, you know, names or referrals or anything like that?
The main difference with me is there's a reason why I'm ringing everyone. Mm-hmm. There's always I never do, you know, when people get lists of candidates and they just ring it, I don't do that. I have my day planned out in 15 minute increments and everyone's got 15 minutes. It does run over, that's why I don't run it that militant, but the 15 minute increments are mm-hmm. pre-planned from the day before. So mm-hmm. that tonight I'll sit here, you know, and I will go through everything that I need to do on Tuesday. I'm actually working this weekend, but everything I need to do on Tuesday, I'll be like, right, I know I need to speak to this person, and I'll list there's 15 minute increments. And you think of how many 15 minutes we've got in a typical work day. I work from 8 till 8. So, because I'm doing both. So yeah, think about how many people you've got to speak to then. That's a lot of people. Not everyone's going to answer the phone. Things will also change. I'll also get directed onto other stuff, but I break my day down militantly so that every person that I ring, I've got a reason for ringing them. It's whether to find out something about the business or anything that I found out that day will spur my business development for the next day.
Okay. Can you give any more examples? So one is, you know, a previous employer of someone that that you're interviewing. What would be some other clues or leads that would spur your business development the next day?
People leaving, unhappy people in general. I think that's a big one. New sites that are coming through. That's a big one for me. So I always go into one thing that we do for business development is we do our roundtable event, which I know we're going to touch on in a bit, but getting high level people in the industry round the table, unfiltered, having good conversations. A lot of people really want to do that because I think that it's a fun thing to do and we all get really drunk and have a great time. Yeah, the roundtable events have been really great for us. Another thing that I do look out for, though, is redundancies. So anytime a business is potentially making any redundancies, we're the first people that we go straight because we hear about things before they happen, which is great for us because it shows how well connected we are in the market. But then at the same time, it's actually protecting the people that are going to be affected by that to be able to say to them, look, like, don't, you know, we're not allowed to say that there's going to be redundancies, but we'll also give them the lifeline by saying, look, we're working on a few opportunities. Let me know if you're interested. Once those things happen, we then are able to get those people out and get them into other roles. That's always a big one for us. Company expansion, that's another one. Whenever we're working with businesses, we do project partners with them. So yeah, we just go through the whole company and see where our value is going to hold in the business and be able to actually offer solutions to things. So another thing that I do think is that when you are experienced in what you're doing and you're going in there confidently, you're able to actually suggest a solution that they've not thought of before. So we've been quite good at wrapping ourselves in these businesses and doing, look, we'll do it as a project. We'll hire 6 people. We'll do this. And it's worked very, very well for us.
Okay, I've made a note to circle back about asking about doing things as a project. So that's interesting. So I want to learn about your day plan, though. That's very meticulous. So
when, my psychotic day plan.
No, it's good. It's good. What time of the day do you sit down and create your plan for the next day? And how long does that take?
Oh, God, it's not going to be a very good representation of running your own business. It's probably around 9 o'clock at night. I'll decompress from the day. So say, for example, yesterday, I worked from 8 o'clock in the morning till 1 o'clock in the morning. And that was because I was just rammed with calls all day and night. It was an office-based day. I went out and had some dinner, and then I then carried on till 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm okay with that. I'm obsessed with the job, so I love it. And I don't expect other people to do that. But my day plan is 9 o'clock at night. I'll look at my day. What have I done today? What's been good? What's been bad? I've worked with my business coach on that. So he said, he was like, you know, you need to do a bit of a close down and shut everything down. I'll then sit there and look at what information we've actually gained from the day. What things have happened? What rumors have we heard? What little, you know, tittles of information have we got? I will then sit down and look at, I structure my day into four quarters.
Yeah.
So I've got early morning, mid morning, early afternoon, mid afternoon. Yeah. And that is because if I have a bad early morning, I've not got to have a bad mid morning. It changes my mentality. So if I don't manage to achieve everything I want to in that early morning, I've still got three other quarters to smash the day. So I'm okay. You know, it's when you start getting to the third quarter, you're like, God, today's been a real shit show.
I like that approach.
Yeah. Great. So that's definitely helped us. But with it being in 15 minute increments, it's broken down into the first is I work from closest to the money to furthest to the money.
Yep.
So we do, in the morning, it's anything that's a live process, CVs out, jobs on, interview feedback, offer management, anything that's going to get us and generate money straight away. The second thing would be candidates. So candidates that we've resourced to speak to the day before are in that pool to speak to about jobs that are going to get us closest to the money. Then we go on to client development, which is all from leads, anything that we've heard in the market, but basically just with the clients. And then the back end of the day is outreach to new things.
Great. I love that structure. That makes total sense. Is your day plan on pen and paper or is it digital?
It's Excel.
It's an Excel spreadsheet?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's an Excel spreadsheet and it's checkboxed, it's color coordinated, it's everything I dream of it to be.
I would love to see that spreadsheet.
Yeah, no, I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
It's definitely a good one. But yeah, I think the thing that I really, really crave is security and process and structure. I do not thrive in chaos. You know, when you see these recruiters that have got paper sprawled on that, like that would just do my nut in. I cannot do that. I have to be really, really organized and know exactly what I'm doing that day so I can walk away and go, I've had a great day because I've achieved everything that I set out to achieve. I am not a reactive recruiter at all. If you ring me and say, I need a job and I need it filling yesterday, no, thank you. I'm okay. Like if you want the best people, you've got to have a process to find those. And each job has a process. Each interview has a process. Each CV sent has a process. Like everything is done by the book and everything has to be ticked before I can move on to the next thing.
Okay. I like that way of thinking for sure. I admire that.
I'm a serial killer.
No. I wish I could be more like that. That's a good thing. So, okay. We've talked about lead generation. We've talked about planning, like your day plan. Tell me about how you're selling solutions rather than just like, you know, going from like they need a job filled and you place a candidate. You're working more strategically and let's do that as a project and you need six hires. Like what? Tell me about how that conversation would go.
So the reason why I'm able to do that is because I do a lot of market intelligence. So when I work with any client, I'll do a reputational analysis straight away. So I'll ring around everyone that I know, everyone in the market, candidates, clients, and I will be like, what do you think of this business? And they'll be like, oh, they're great. You know, they're a really great business, but I know that they struggle with this. And I will just get the intelligence from the market, including people that work there. You know, it's not sort of, you don't stay away from the business. I want to be underneath it. I'll go into the business. I will get a vibe of their office. I'll get a vibe of what they're doing, how they communicate with each other. It's just little things. There's a small details that make it a lot easier to sell solutions. You need to find a pain point with everyone. And the pain point is usually either retention, culture, actual recruitment itself, you know, attracting the best people, marketing. So we are able to go in there and actually analyze their business. So we are more of a business consultancy now, as well as a recruitment consultancy, because we spend a lot of time in the companies to actually see if it's something that we want to be involved in. At the end of the day, it's, my business and it's my reputation, not anyone else's. And as you know, I've worked in recruitment companies and I've left recruitment companies, and those businesses haven't changed because I left. So it's always going to fall down on me, because I'm very much in the mindset of I have to be being the best that we are and representing the best companies, or having the best outcome to ensure that people are going to refer us to other people. So we'll just go in there, analyze all of that, and then we'll say to them, look, this is what we found from the market. This is what people have been saying about your company, or, you know, your directors. This is the reason why people have left. And we go really, really, really deep on it. And we sit down with the HR departments. We do everything. From that, we can then say to them, right, you've really struggled with this area. You know, it sounds like construction, your operations is your hardest point. Let's analyze all the site managers you've got. When was the last time you did PDRs? What was your feedback? How would you genuinely feel about them? Is there anyone that you'd want to move on? All that sort of stuff. We can then assist in that and go in there and actually sit down with the managers. And if they aren't happy, like I can say, look, you know, I do work with the business, but if you aren't happy, like there is other opportunities out there. And they're always very like, yeah, do you know what? I'm just not feeling it. We can then obviously, we do consult the business on that, by the way. So it's not done behind the company's back. We would then consult the business and say, look, you know, from what we've found, you know, this person that you've identified that wasn't happy, genuinely isn't happy, like, are we okay to find them another opportunity and then backfill? And that's just the way I do it.
Okay. I've never heard that strategy before. This is interesting. Going back to the reputational assessment, what do you have a name for this?
It's just a reputational analysis that I do. It's just an analysis. So it's nothing too formal.
How long does that take?
I do it every day. Like I do it now. Say for example, even though I don't work with companies, I'm collecting data on them at all times. So
okay.
I will always, anytime I have a conversation or hear anything about a business, whether it's good or bad, I've got our CRM. I'll just put a little note on of what the feedback's been. And then when that company does eventually come to the dark side, working with me, they will have, the reputational analysis is there. And I hear about these things every day. You know, you hear about some businesses and everyone's like, oh, I don't want to work there. And I'm like, why? Because, you know, nosy me. What is it about them? And I just pull the information ever so slowly. But then when we do any retained projects, reputational analysis is part of our retained document. So we have to just collate all that information and refresh it and speak to new people. But yeah, it's every day is a reputational analysis. There's some clients that I'll hear of from people and they sound absolutely amazing. I'm like, I have to work with them. And that'll be then my BD strategy is like, I've heard amazing things about you. Like, you know, I really want to work with you guys. And that normally works as well. It's the way I recruit is so different and it's so hard to teach, which has been impossible setting up a business.
So hang on a second. So I understand you're constantly talking to people in the market and you're gathering intelligence about different companies. But as far as collating and presenting something meaningful back to that employer, do you charge for that or how?
So we would charge for the reputational analysis if it's something that it asked for. I normally sort of, it sounds very sadistic, doesn't it? But I go in there giving a little bit of like a breadcrumb of like, you know, I've talking to a few people in the market, I've had a bit of feedback about your company and, you know, I just wanted to discuss it with you and we'll give them a light version, like the free version, which is not in depth at all. They'll then come back to us and be like, you know, I'm really interested in hearing what else was said. And I'll be like, well, you know, that's gonna cost you a bit of money. Like, you know, you've got to present it in a way that they want to hear it. Because I mean, I did one recently and the client, someone in the business requested it. So they paid for it, did it. The managing director put it in the bin and said, I don't give a about the opinions of people that don't work here. And I was like, oh, brilliant. That's great. That's been received so well.
That's not a great sign, is it?
No, I know. But some people don't want to hear it and some people do. That's just, you know, and it's not a bad thing if you don't want to hear it. You can live in your delusional world of I'm the best and no one else is better than me. But the reality is that I thrive on feedback. So every time I work with a client or a candidate, I always get a testimonial afterwards because I need to know what their experience was like. And it helps me then because I'll just be dead on it. Just be dead honest. Like they'll tell me on the phone, I'll always ask for feedback and constructive criticism, but I always like a testimonial because it just kind of solidifies that I've done a good job.
I love it. Absolutely. We try and do the same thing. So, but coming to the project, when you call it projects, like this is just a
multi-hire retained search. Some people call it an RPO. Like we've signed a lot of exclusive agreements, which has been great for us because we are we've got guaranteed clients that can't be taken, can't be, I mean, they can always be taken, but I'm not naive to that. But we would go in there and we'd sit down and actually put a plan together and be able to actually strategize of how we're going to achieve that plan, what time frame we're going to do it in. And it's just a lot more project-based rather than the contingent, quick, you know, I just need something here and here and here. Like I met up with a client this afternoon and we've been doing a lot of their recruitment exclusively for operational positions. And they were like, right, I said, you know, we've done these ones. We filled three, which they were looking for. They are all done. And then I was like, right, what's coming up next? And he was like, well, in September, we're going to need this, this, and this. And so I will then put together a project of the areas that they're recruiting for, what type of people are in those areas, and then present that when they are ready to hire. But it'll all be done anyway, because if I don't put them there, I'll put them somewhere else. So it's just anything that I do isn't a waste of time, because I will use that information at some time.
Yep, fair enough. That makes sense. So then how do you charge for that project? Is it like a monthly retainer? Is it like some upfront and
no,
the rest?
It's just a collection of fees. So whatever the project is, so say for example, you are recruiting. So say recently I did two director roles within one business. So we did that as a retained project where they paid upfront for it. And it was a percentage on salary and package, like as normal. But that was a project that we started back in November. And we did the long list, the short list, all the rest of it. And it was, you know, all NDA driven and stuff like that. But yeah, that was a project that they paid upfront for anyway. But obviously on completion, they completed at different times. So one completed earlier, one completed more recently. And then now we get the back end of the fee, but that retainer is what secures that project. So
That was just two retainers then, basically.
Yeah, two big retainers, but we call it a project because we then go on to then place the rest of their team. So one of the retainers that we did, we then placed four people in their team straight after. So that was then done as a project separately.
So then if you have, let's say, four, five, six searches to do, are you basically just charging them like six times the normal retainer, or how do you structure
so
that?
It depends on the client. We sometimes do a retainer if they're, you know, a high level role, which is retained on a higher percentage anyway. The lower level stuff, we will just do it as an exclusive agreement, and we will have exclusivity on the whole thing, but it's done within a certain time frame. So we just call it a project. Like it might, other people might be like, yeah, but that's just a normal job. Like we would invoice on either the point where we're engaging with them, we'll invoice part of the fee, which is the collection of the fees that are going to be all together, or we'll just invoice on completion. I'm not really too bothered. It's not, the thing is that the project work isn't a financial benefit for me. It's the case of, I like to be organized. I like to have a guaranteed outcome. I just like the control factor. It's not I need to get money in the biz. Like we are doing absolutely fine financially. So for me, the retainers and the upfront cost of a project has no benefit to me, because you can pay upfront all you want. If I can't fill it, I'm not going to fill it. I'm not going to make any more money. So it's just having the control and the commitment from the client on an
control and commitment, 100%.
The biggest things.
I agree. Oh, we are running short on time here.
I know. So I feel like that's flown by.
There's two more things. So first of all, I really want to know about your round tables, because we actually recently ran a training session for our clients on hosting live events, because we have some of our clients who do that on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. I'd love to learn what inspired you to do that and how it actually works.
Well, I was doing, with any high level clients, I am out and about. I'm face to face with everything. That's my biggest business development strategy. I'm face to face with everything. Mm-hmm. I always take my clients out for dinner, always take them out for drinks. We have a great time together. And I just sat there one day and thought, you know, so much time is spent individually doing this with these people. I'm going to bring them all together. None of them know each other. Like, they know each other, but none of them, they're not all good mates and they can all go out together. But I thought, you know, I hand select people that are going to get on with each other. I do a table plan. Before the event, I send out a questionnaire of something that person would want to talk about. It's all anonymous. So send out a bit of a form, you know, what do you want to eat, all the rest of it. And then at the end of it, it says, what one thing do you want to ask at this roundtable event that you would be keen to hear from the other people that are there? So it's a bit of a subject starter. I will then get all those forms back and I will be able to create questions from those subject topics that people want. And then as the round table, the people come to the event, as the round table happens, people, I ask the questions and everyone just answers it. But the more everyone has to drink, the worse the answers get. So, you know, you've got to kind of get the questions done at the start and then at the end, then everyone can just have a great time. But they are really, really, they've been great for us. We actually, two of the clients that came did a land deal recently together, which was absolutely amazing. So yeah, that's been really, really fun.
Wait, so you introduced two companies and they end up doing a deal together?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a great opportunity for people to talk somewhere that isn't a industry event, essentially, because there are events that they all see each other at, but it's not the type of place that you'd have the conversations that we were having. It's a very, very safe space. Like, no one talks about anything that was spoken about there. You know, if it's very, very clear cut that like nothing's discussed out of that room. Obviously, the land deal was a public thing, so everyone could know about it. But the roundtable events themselves, I wanted to just create a safe space for people to connect. And I think that it's a hard thing to do in this industry because you've always got people listening. And I think everyone, it made it apparent that everyone has the same problem, but some are bigger than others and some are more complicated than others. But the roundabout thing is the same issue.
For sure. Absolutely. And so how many people are you getting together for one
eight.
Of these rounds? Eight people. Okay.
Yeah, it's always eight. Never.
Why
more.
Eight? How'd you come up with that number?
Because I don't know really, actually. I think it's eight, including me.
Okay.
So I sit in the middle, like the queen of the table.
Of course.
And I just feel like it's enough people to get some good value and scope because everyone works at different size companies. There's some businesses that are large national house builders, some that are smaller regional companies. And I can just control the narrative a little bit more. I hope in the future, you know, we grow and it's a bigger thing and, you know, it's extended to, I think next year we're looking at doing individual divisions such as like land and technical and stuff like that. But at the moment, it's just executive. But I just think eight's a nice number.
Okay.
I feel like it's controllable. Like, it, you know, you're not, I try and avoid everyone having little conversations between
right,
themselves.
Right, right.
I think it's,
you're
I think
trying
it's,
to have a conversation between everyone.
Everyone
is this over
is
dinner or what's the
so it's always yeah it's like an early afternoon type thing, so it's like 3 o'clock-ish.
Okay.
I book out a private dining room somewhere and we all just have loads to eat, loads to drink, have a laugh, and it's I mean, I feel like I'm going out with my friends, so I've got like the best social life ever in this job. But it's a really, really lovely day and we just have fun, and then we always go out to the bars afterwards and just get even more drunk, and then after that
okay.
go home.
And wait, so how often are you doing these roundtables?
So we are doing the once every 6 months, but we're going to be upping that and doing the once every 3 months now.
Okay, so like a quarterly cadence. And are do you charge for this or
no,
are you okay
we cover the
you're
cost.
Covering the cost. That must get pricey with all, I mean, are they doing, you're paying for the meal, but are they doing the drinks? Is that, or you're
no,
covering
no,
everything?
No, I pay for absolutely everything.
Wow. That must cost a fair packet per, I mean, I could see that being a few grand per.
Yeah. So it is a couple of grand, if I'm honest. The only thing is, if I'm honest, if I put it into perspective, if I end up working with that person from that event, 2 grand is absolutely nothing.
Sure. I
am not bothered.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm a very short-term loss, long-term gain person. I am so okay with paying 2 grand if that means that my reputation is solidified and people have enjoyed themselves and they go. And, you know, now I have conversations with people. They're like, why did you not invite me? And I'm like, well, I know you'll come to the next one. And it's a really good conversation starter, but I do, yeah, it's a lot of money, but I also have the best time ever and I make it fun and it's enjoyable and everyone has a good time and we just enjoy it.
This is cool. Awesome. Love it. Just before I let you go, I want to ask about your US because you live part-time in the US and part-time in the UK. So
yeah,
which just sounds exhausting to me, but
yeah.
How does that actually work?
So we spend 4 months of the year in the US.
Okay.
It's like an extended holiday. I mean, I run the UK from the US and I run the US from the UK and cross over, but it's nice to actually be face-to-face. I mean, I'm very, very big on the face-to-face thing. So me seeing clients and being present over there is really important, even though I am working here. The US has always held a really, really, I was actually meant to move to America last year with this business that I ended up leaving before I started setting up the business. And I was going to move to Austin. You know, Austin's one of my markets, and it was all planned and I was ready. House had gone, the lot, and I just pulled the plug and I was like, oh, I can't do this. And it wasn't the case that I don't want to move to America. I was just moving to America under the wrong circumstances. So the long-term goal for me is to be over there eventually. All my clients in the UK will probably still work with me whilst I'm over there. They're so used to it. But the American market for me is, it's exciting. It's new. I think when you've done the same market for a long time, you crave newness. Like I want to start again sometimes, and I don't want to change my market because I love it, and I love construction, I love house building. So I just decided that that's what I would do in America.
Well, look, I think this explains the long hours you're doing is you're covering two countries at the same time.
It's stressful.
That's rough. That's kind of crazy, Alicia.
I know, but you know what? I actually wouldn't have it any other way. I am so obsessed with the job. I absolutely love it. And I just love speaking to people and getting to know people and supporting businesses. And I think that the US market is very transactional and it's missing my personal touch.
Okay. Well, I have no doubt that you will win them over. By the way, Alicia, something's been bugging me in the back of my mind as we've been talking is you say you don't cold call, but in my definition, you do. Because if you're calling someone who's not expecting your call, like it's not a scheduled appointment and you don't personally know them, to me, that's a cold call. Even if you have a referral or a valid reason for calling, it's just that you're putting a lot of research into your cold calls so that they're more successful that way.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
So I see a cold call as a cold call. It's got no warmness to it. It's got no, you know, it's got nothing behind it. I think if it was I can't schedule calls with people a lot of the time because I've just got to catch them when I can. And I mean, I rang someone 11 times yesterday and I sent a message to them this morning, like, do I need to come and find you? And he went, come into the office. Like, I was like, you know, I am very brash when it comes to my approach. Technically, and you know, like logistically, it probably is cold calling.
Okay, no problem. Well, we just have different terminology.
Definitions,
But now I understand.
It's never a call that someone doesn't know me. That's my idea. A cold call. When I get a cold call from someone, it's like, who are you? What do you? I don't know them. They're not even anyone that I've even come across. I don't even know who they are. But then if someone rang me and said, oh, I spoke to said person the other day and your name was mentioned, I'd be like, oh, okay. Interesting.
I completely get it. And I can see why it's an effective strategy. So Alicia, next time we chat, because we've not even touched personal branding, LinkedIn, all that other stuff. But one more question I need to ask before you go, because I know that my audience is going to be annoyed at me if I don't ask this. Tech stack, AI, what are you doing? Like, what are the tools that you rely on for your business?
ChatGPT is just me and ChatGPT are like that. I do love it. okay. I don't think a lot of people admit that, if I'm honest, because I think that it does save a lot of brain power for me. You know, I format CVs in there. You know, it helps me write emails that I'm, you know, struck. I'm not very good with my words. I'm a waffler. I talk a lot and I'm a yapper. And sometimes I over-explain things to get my point across. Even though I am very direct, I still do tend to over-explain. ChatGPT just kind of shortens everything down, makes it, you know, good and ready to go. As I said, it does my CV formatting. It creates specs for me in a format that I like. And I've set it up so it's like automated, so it does it the way that I like it. We use a CRM called JobAdder. All our templates on the system. So every time we send a candidate, they get an email with a confirmation of details sent. Every time we book an interview, everything's templated. So there's not really anything to think about. You can just like do, 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 and it just goes straight away. Other stuff that we've got, LinkedIn Recruiter. I'm actually connected with a lot of the people on LinkedIn. So when it comes to markets that I'm doing, I never actually use any emails. I've got hundreds of emails waiting to be used. So that's one thing that we use is LinkedIn. And that's it, really. We just keep it simple. I don't like to complicate things. And, you know, I know a lot of people use note takers I'm fine writing notes and I'm fine sitting there at the end of a day and just catching up on the admin stuff that I need to do. That doesn't bother me.
Okay. I think, look, there's not even time. I want to agree to disagree on that, but there's not time to get into it. But
next
fair
time.
Enough. So it's JobAdder. It's ChatGPT. It's LinkedIn Recruiter. It's like your main tech stack. Mm-hmm. So Alicia, This has been fun. Thank you so much for being on the show.
No, thank you for having me. I've loved it.
Great. Me too. Take care. Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.